Hello, Lightspeed listeners. You have Nicole Quinn from Lightspeed with you today, and I am so excited to have one of my personal favorite beauty brands, the CEO and founder of Ipsy, Marcelo, with us today. Hello,
hey,
Marcelo.
Nicole, how are you? Great to be here.
Very excited to have you. So Marcelo and I actually started off life in a similar way. We both spent too many years in banking. Marcelo at JP Morgan, myself at Morgan Stanley. Marcelo is also a fellow Stanford GSB-er. Boy, has he done some interesting things post-GSB. Excited to chat about those today.
Cool.
There were the couple of years that Marcelo spent at Will Ferrell's Funny or Die.
Yes. I'm the die part of Funny or Die.
So. More to come on that. There were the couple of years that Marcelo spent as CEO and founder of Real Influence. And then CEO of one of the best known millennial beauty businesses today, Ipsy. I'd love to kind of kick off with your time at Funny or Die. You were one of the very first employees there and very early to the influencer world.
Yeah.
So tell us about, you know, what you saw in the influencer world in the early days.
Sure. When I joined Funny or Die, I already had some experience working with celebrities and in media. I had launched an events business called World Business Forum. My transition from banking was I was on the board of a company called the World Business Forum that was based in Latin America. And so I launched it here in the US. It was a great experience. It was e-learning and conferences. But when I got to Funny or Die, I never worked with like real celebrities, quote unquote. And so it was just kind of fun. It seemed like something good to do after business school. And really excited about the opportunity. I think I was like the second or third employee to join. To be honest, the interesting thing about Funny or Die is that they didn't work with influencers. And so it was a new digital media company, and it was really going after, this was when YouTube was not, you know, YouTube had just gotten started, basically. What they were trying to do was they were trying to go into the intersection of YouTube, but doing it with much more professional, high-level content. Do you remember the video, The Landlord? Have you seen that one?
Yes.
That's what we launched with.
Very
and
cool.
That was actually, people think it was Will Ferrell's daughter, but it was actually Adam McKay's daughter and two-year-old daughter. And it was incredibly funny. And that really got the company off the ground. But it wasn't really about working with influencers. It was about working with up-and-coming comedy talent that maybe hadn't gotten there yet, but which Will and Adam and sort of this really, really talented production team thought had great potential. And so they discovered amazing talent like Zach Galifianakis and Aziz Ansari and Ed Helms and, you know, all these people. Like, before The Hangover, nobody knew them. Or actually, people in the comedy community really knew them, but they weren't very well known. And so it wasn't really until later where I really try to bring influencers to Funny or Die. You know, I'll tell you a story. I basically looked at the top 25 comedy, quote unquote, YouTubers, right? This was before there was a term even called influencers. It was just YouTubers. And I emailed the top 25 of them and I said, hey, I'd love to meet you and see how we can work together with Funny or Die. And today you would get zero responses. Back then, nobody had a manager. Like I think a couple of them had their moms as managers. And so all of them got back to me and I met with all 25 of them and they all wanted to work with us. The problem is Will didn't think they were funny. CA, who was our partner at the time, didn't think that they were very talented or marketable. Eventually, I left Funny or Die to start my next company, Real Influence, because I thought there was something really, really interesting there.
So now that is something that I want to talk about, Real Influence. We have a lot of listeners who are startup founders themselves or who have a passionate desire to start something. So tell us about when you had always worked for someone else's company, why you decided to take that leap and start your business, and tell us a little bit about it.
It's hard to know right now because it was such a leap of faith. I mean, there was really just an inkling of an idea there that it was all about influencers were changing the world, basically. And I had seen the power of influencers and I just really, really believed in it. I didn't know exactly how I was going to harness them. And in fact, started with all kinds of crazy ideas. And eventually I got to a concept that was more a marketplace trying to connect YouTube influencers with brands. And that didn't really work either. And so we turned into more of an agency where it was a few brands that really, you know, we worked very closely with, and then a few influencers that we had really great relationships with. And then we were putting the two together. We had maybe 8 to 10 people in the company. So it was a really small company, but it was a lot of fun. It was just not necessarily what I wanted to do, because I wanted to do something a little bit more scalable, a little bit more product oriented, and just more of a technology. That's really how I got more deeper into the influencer world, and went to the first Playlist Live, which is a conference that's now bigger, you know, probably the second VidCon when nobody was going to these things, and just really got to know all the influencers and try to understand kind of what the opportunity was.
It's good to hear as well that you wanted to do something more scalable, because that is exactly what you did. Then you went over to Ipsy, and I know a lot of our listeners would love to hear how it all began at Ipsy.
When I started getting to know the influencers, I saw that there was an obvious opportunity in beauty, and I started seeing how Michelle Phan and other, we call them creators now, at the time they were YouTubers, were really changing the world of beauty. And I thought, hey, I'm really struggling here to get, really was born out of a frustration that I was, you know, we were calling on all these digital media agencies, and they were getting amazing results, but it was so hard. There was so much friction in trying to convince them to work with us. And I was like, wow, if we just had a service of our own that we could promote, then this would be so easy. You know, I know all the influencers. I know how to work with them. I know they have tremendous power. So now all I need is something, a community that we can build on our own. And so the goal was really, how can we build a community around beauty and around these influencers? And thought, subscription, not knowing anything about e-commerce, by the way, don't do this. Don't get into subscription because it's so, so hard. But I thought at the time, you know, coming from banking background, oh, all right, these numbers really work out here. This is pretty easy. All I have to do is get people in the door and then they stay with us for a long time. It's obviously not as easy as that. That was the idea. The idea was like, we have this great potential with YouTube influencers, particularly in beauty, who are totally changing the way that millennials discover beauty products. And if we just have a community that we can really promote, then we can really put the two together. And subscription was the connective tissue to build that community. And so that's really how we got started. You know, I had gotten to know Michelle Phan a little bit through Real Influence, and had gotten to know her manager. And so, you know, pitched the idea to them, and they signed on as the face of the company, and then started to find other influencers that thought would be really a good fit together with Michelle. And that's how we got off the ground. We got off the ground November 21st in 2011, and it just kind of took off from day one.
Wow. And there's something in there that you said that I found fascinating, which was subscription is so, so hard. We've obviously seen a couple of consumer subscription companies IPO in the last year.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, Stitch Fix.
Yes.
So while there's been great success in subscription, I have definitely seen a lot of these businesses have hard times.
Yeah.
But I'd love to kind of hear from you a little bit more about what's hard in subscription, and then what you guys did well in subscription.
A lot of things are hard in subscription, and it depends what subscription. I mean, it's there's so many different flavors. It's like saying retail, right? Like there's 100 different ways to do retail, and there's 100 different ways to do subscription. A couple of things that are hard is, you know, the operational part of it is very hard, and a lot of companies have struggled early on with that. So just payments, operations, fulfillment, shipping, all this stuff is really, really hard. Ultimately, it's about getting your LTV to CAC really working, and a lot of companies struggle on the CAC side. It's kind of a hard service to explain, and so they're not really getting the CAC that they really need to make it successful. A lot of companies struggle with retention, right? Like our retention is, you know, even Stitch Fix, which is a company I really admire, and Katrina's an amazing entrepreneur, but the business itself, when you look at the retention, if you look at the public numbers out there, you know, after 12 months, you have 20% of customers that are still with you. For us, it's 50%. When you look at Blue Apron, it's 10% or something like that. And so you really need to have a loyal, stable customer base. And that just really comes back to the product. Like, are you having a product or service that really, really makes sense? How many people can you bring on based on those retention metrics? And so It's a highly analytical, highly difficult business to operate in every single way. So I don't even know where to start. But it can also be a super fulfilling business, right? Because you can plan it out so far in advance. There's so much predictability to the revenue. There's so much predictability to kind of the gross margin profile. So when you get it right, it can really be magical, and it can really allow you to expand beyond subscription into many, many different things.
So I'm glad you said that, because I was going to push back on the logistics side of things, because I feel like what you're saying in logistics is true of every e-commerce business, but at least in subscription, you have that returning customer.
Yeah.
You know, with a much better degree of accuracy, the number of customers that are going to be returning as well as the new ones.
Yeah.
So you have far less spikiness in your business than some other e-commerce businesses. So that's definitely something I like about subscription.
Yeah.
Another question I wanted to speak to you about was, at Lightspeed, we often hear Snap users say that Snapchat is the new place for infomercials. And we've definitely seen that with some of our companies finding real success advertising there, especially for the younger demographic. After Ipsy launched, you were introduced to Jennifer Goldfarb.
Yes.
Who I met and think is brilliant. She previously ran the infomercial business for Bare Essentials. So I'd love to better understand how you both see product discovery at Snap or Instagram draw from infomercials of the past.
Jen is my co-founder. She is amazing, an amazing entrepreneur and operator, and really would not be here without her in terms of Ipsy, because she actually knew how to build a big, you know, operational company that's delivering delight every single month. Infomercials, they don't really work in my mind for millennials, in the sense that it's got to be a lot more authentic. So yes, you can talk about being reinventing. I would just call it, it's just completely different. It's like, what's really working, right, is just authentically, people authentically loving a product or service, and then just doing things to augment that and really creating, you know, experiences that on Snapchat and other channels that augment that. So an example of that is, you know, Anastasia early on. Like, I think now they're maybe not doing as well as they were before, but, you know, with Instagram and with Instagram stories, they really grew because people, you know, they had really people who authentically loved the product and who had experience. They really were able to then create experiences that encompassed those people. And so, you know, Anastasia would have parties or get-togethers in her house in LA, and her daughter Nervina would really be friends with some of the bigger influencers, and they would, you know, get together. And so the product was not, it wasn't an infomercial. It was just people authentically getting together with that founder, with that product. And that's, you know, that's partly why you see some of these influencer led brands that are doing so well, because the ability to market them is so much easier because it's really authentic. And so when you think about Kylie, or when you think about Huda and beauty, you know, they are who they are, right? So they're so intrinsically linked with the brand. So it doesn't need to be this push type of marketing. It can just really be authentically integrated. There's other more hacks that you can do. Like if you don't have a celebrity founder, which most people don't have, or if you really want to get a product out there and get it started, I think there's other hacks that you can do in terms of integrating celebrities and influencers into more infomercial type situations, I guess. And I don't want to say that they don't work, but I think of them more as just social paid ads at that point. And it's just, you know, you create something, and then it's all about how you augment that and how you target people with that ad or with that, you know, testimonial, how you target the right people. So it's in some ways, it's just a different form of creative.
Mm. Stepping away from infomercials, influencers, you've been at Ipsy now for nearly 8 years.
yeah.
You've certainly seen the beauty industry change over that time. So I'd love to better understand maybe like the top couple of ways in which you have seen beauty change.
So when we started, it was the beauty industry was changing from one that was all about authority. And so you looked at Sephora, and Sephora called itself the beauty authority when we started. Allure called themselves the beauty authority. Believe it or not, they had the exact same slogan. Like, they were both the beauty authority. And so when we came in, we thought we were sort of the anti-authority. We were about democratizing authority away from the traditional editors or the traditional, you know, makeup counter, towards all these YouTubers, all these influencers who didn't think of themselves as an authority figure. They thought of themselves as somebody who has a perspective, who has a different opinion, and who, you know, in their living rooms or wherever they're at, they're just kind of talking to their audience and their mainly niche audience and saying things that might inspire them to be themselves and to kind of have a unique perspective. And so I think that, that's been a dramatic change, and it took some companies a long time to understand that, but I think everybody's pretty much accepting that. I see it changing in a different way now, and I think Glossier would be an example of that change, where it's going more towards, even more towards community and even more towards kind of smaller groups. And I think it's reflective of kind of how, not millennials, but kind of the next generation is using media, which is in smaller groups, right? And they are not looking for that one-to-many relationship in the same way that they used to. And they want to hear what their friends have to say, and they want to kind of, you know, they want smaller experiences. We're looking at ways to adapt to that. I think there's still a lot of people who think, okay, it's got to be, everything has to be about big. I like the brands that are starting to think small, you know, and how do we make small scalable? Glossier being an example, you know, they did this pop-up here in San Francisco for all the people who are, you know, in the Bay Area that I think was really smart and interesting. It's harder to scale small, right? Because it's not just like a one size fit all. You really need a bigger structure internally to be able to scale small. And you need a lot of different tech functions, and you need a lot of different things. But that's probably what I'm most excited in terms of changes that are coming up.
Amazing. Again, yeah. My final question for you. As a man in the beauty industry, you've been a great leader in amplifying strong women. What advice would you have for other male founders and executives and other listeners on our podcast today in terms of how they can be effective allies and partners to women in their companies?
I think it's being a good partner to women and minorities. I would extend it. Building an inclusive environment from day one, it's like anything culturally, right? It's hard to change once you get started with something. From the very beginning, I mean, we have, and I'll call us weird. We're like a weird group of people, you know, like we have all from every walk of life, you know, like the least that you'll have is like a white male, you know, and it's not by design. It's just, it just happened, I guess. It wasn't really that we set out to build an inclusive culture. When we hire people, we don't try to find people who we think, we don't set out to with the whole like, hey, would you be excited about, you know, getting a drink with this person? Because I think that can lead to kind of you wanting to spend time with other people who are like you. And so it's more about people who you think are talented and people who you think are interesting and just people who you think. One of the questions I always ask people is like, tell me sometime that you actually really didn't get along with somebody, but then kind of turned it around and ended up being friends with somebody. And I think a lot of people have those stories of somebody that you actually, you know, thought was a total jerk at the beginning, and then you kind of ended up really liking that person. And so I think it's just about hiring and culture and just bringing in the right people at the beginning. And, you know, I'm really excited that Jen, for example, is now executive chairwoman. Frankly, I've always had women bosses, so this is normal for me. So I'm really excited to go back to that and have leadership from somebody that really understands the industry.
That's amazing. So many lessons that I took away from this, and hopefully our listeners did too. Marcelo, thank you so much.
Thanks, Nicole. Appreciate it.
This podcast is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. For more details on this episode, head over to tbtpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.